Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll be joined by Heidi Barrick from the Southern Poverty Law Center to talk about Trump and the rise of the so-called alt-right. Then we'll have a kind of Olympics post-mortem with Dave Zirin, my colleague at The Nation. We're going to talk about what happens after all the medals are given out and the celebrations are over for Rio. Finally, because those are kind of heavy segments, we'll be joined by Rebecca Schoenkopf of Wonkette. She and I will talk about some quirky, kind of Wonkette-y stories. But first, Donald Trump, as you know, hires only the best people. And this week he proved that once again by hiring Bill Stepien, a former advisor to Chris Christie, who was fired for his involvement in the so-called Bridgegate scandal. Now, to be fair, he wasn't indicted for it. He wasn't one of the people who were indicted. Eric Trump, one of the Donald's evil-looking sons. You know, they both kind of remind me of every, like, frat boy perpetrator of a heinous crime on Law & Order. They're like rich bullies from Central Casting. If you called up Central Casting, you were like, I need a rich, arrogant-looking bully, they would send one of Trump's sons. Anyway, Eric Trump gave an interview explaining his father's rationale for getting into this presidential race. One factor, he told The Stream, which I've never actually heard of, was the war on Christmas. Eric said, and I quote, he sees the tree on the White House lawn has been renamed Holiday Tree instead of Christmas Tree. And this so infuriated him, the renaming of the Christmas tree, the White House Christmas tree, that he decided to run a quixotic campaign for the presidency. Sounds like someone's been watching or believing too much Fox News, because, of course, the White House Christmas tree is still called the White House Christmas tree. There's a saying in the Caribbean, sheep don't get goat. It's like the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And it seems apropos. I think the Trump family, the entire family, has problems with veracity. Let's put it that way. But the big Trump news this week was his ongoing, should we say, not pivot, his going squishy, all squishy on immigration, his signature issue. And I can't tell you where his position is exactly right now, because he's been all over the place this week. But he at least signaled that he'd be open to letting undocumented immigrants who have been here for a while pay back taxes and stay, which freaked out Ann Coulter, among other people, because she'd just come out with an Insta book lavishing praise on Trump's xenophobia. Also, a bunch of white supremacists freaked out. One guy called Glenn Beck and threatened to kill Trump if he didn't build the wall and make Mexico pay for it. But others seemed to be okay with it, because that's just politics. They were like, yeah, well, he has to soften his rhetoric for the general election, which is kind of cuts across his selling point as being a guy who says what he thinks. Guy who's not PC and says what he thinks. Meanwhile, Politico reports, and I quote, if she wins the presidency, Hillary Clinton would likely enjoy the shortest honeymoon period of any incoming commander-in-chief in recent history, confronting major roadblocks to enacting her ambitious agenda, as well as Republican attacks that have been muted courtesy of the GOP nominee. So whatever happens, really, whatever happens in November, we're in for 4 or perhaps 8 extraordinarily ugly years in American politics. And on that happy note, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back.
Killing me, and I'm Conservatism as we have known it. This is not republicanism as we have known it. These are racist ideas, race-baiting ideas, anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, anti-women, all key tenets making up the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right.
Welcome back to the show. That audio was a snippet from Hillary Clinton's speech this week denouncing the so-called alt-right. What is the alt-right? Well, to help us work that out, I'm really happy to be joined now by Heidi Barrick. Heidi heads the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. Heidi, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
You know, I didn't know whether to welcome you to the show or welcome you back to the show. I think we had you on back when it was called the Alternate Radio Hour, but I could be wrong because when you do a weekly show, it's hard enough to remember who you had on like a few weeks back, much less a few years back.
I think I might have been on that show now that you bring up the name.
Yeah, I think we had you on at least one time, but I think it was probably like 3 years ago. Anyway, Heidi, what was your reaction to Clinton's speech this week?
Well, look, here at the Southern Poverty Law Center for the last 6 months or so, maybe longer, we've been very concerned about the relationship that has been built between the alt-right, which are basically white supremacists with a new name, and the Trump campaign. We've been very concerned about Trump pandering to their ideas, whether it's racism against immigrants or anti-Muslim views or tweeting ideas that come directly from these people. So we've been writing about it. And so we share the concerns that the candidate at this point has been taken over by ideas that we consider absolutely reprehensible, heinous, and dangerous.
Now, my sense is that this is a new incarnation of a very old strain in American politics. Like, you could go back and you could look at the American Bund or the Birchers with their similar conspiracy theories and kind of toxic mix of conspiracism and xenophobia, that they've always kind of been out there in the fever swamps. At the same time, there does seem to be a sort of newish facet to this in that it's online, it's perhaps younger. Some say that it got its start in Gamergate, which was this kind of misogynistic backlash to women getting into the video game and, I guess, comics business. What's old and what's new? Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I think the way you're characterizing this so-called movement is correct. I mean, there's absolutely nothing new about advocating for white interests or white political control, or the idea that people of color in some way are harming white interests or even killing white people. That's one of the narratives here, that black crime against white people is completely out of control. There's nothing new about any of that. You can go back to nativism in the 19th century, and the immigrant hordes were coming here as well to take out white people. I mean, these are old ideas. Usually they're considered, under the banner of white supremacy. The racist movement itself tried to rebrand itself as white nationalist over the last 10 years or so, because that sounds a little less awful than white supremacy, even they are sensitive to this. And alt-right is just the newest incarnation of these same ideas, because white nationalism screams racism, so they took the white out of there. So those are the things that are continuous, this kind of xenophobia, anti-immigrant ideas, racism, they've been around a long time. But you point to the things that are a little bit different about the leadership here. A young crop of basically racist millennials has popped up on this scene, a bunch of people under 30, basically, and they are certainly more tech-savvy than their elders. So they have harnessed, memes and Twitter and Facebook and all these kinds of ideas that lurk in the places of 4chan and 8chan and, like you said, Gamergate, technology and techniques to use the internet to get their messaging out that is new. So the technology's new and the ideas are essentially old.
Now, Trump named Steve Bannon as his campaign's, CEO, they call it, last week. I don't know. I've never heard of a campaign having a CEO, but he formerly ran Breitbart.com. Hillary Clinton actually name-checked your organization when she talked about Breitbart. Where does Breitbart come into all this?
Well, the interesting thing about Breitbart is, a far-right website, has been for a while. It was founded in, 2006, 2007. But in the last year, the site has been increasingly friendly to ideas from the alt-right, to the point where the headlines on Breitbart look like something off of Daily Stormer or the Council of Conservative Citizens website. We started noticing this, early this year, sometime in the last year, and finally wrote about it in April when it got to the point where Breitbart's ideas were becoming indistinguishable in many ways from this alt-right movement. In other words, there were white supremacist ideas, terrible things written about Muslims, immigrants, women, all kinds of stuff on Breitbart, which was astounding. I mean, I may not agree with the views on National Review, which is, a stalwart conservative publication, but I would never compare National Review to these ugly websites I'm talking about. But Breitbart has, in a way, fused itself with racist websites. And Steve Bannon's even said, we are the voice of the alt-right. So that alliance has been made overt.
Yeah. Now, some progressives have criticized Hillary Clinton's speech because they thought she basically gave a pass to the conservative movement writ large for exploiting white racial anxieties for the past two generations. So she said, look, this is not what Republicans do. This is, she praised Speaker Paul Ryan. She praised John McCain. And yet, we do see voter ID laws, all of these accusations of voter fraud with a wink and a nod that it's being perpetrated by minorities. How would you distinguish between the alt-right and the conservative most edge of the mainstream? Like a politician like, Jeff Sessions, who has always given a nod and a wink to the far right. How have these groups overlapped before
Sure.
Trump's campaign?
Well, look, I would probably put Jeff Sessions more in the alt-right camp. I mean, he's been hard for Donald Trump since the beginning. He didn't get a position on the federal bench back in the 80s for making racist comments. And he spends all his time with anti-immigrant hate groups like the Federation for American Immigration Reform. But I get the point that you're making, right?
Yeah, he was the most extreme one that came to my mind.
Yeah. No, I get the point that you're making, though. There's no question that the Republicans, especially with the Southern strategy, have done dog whistle politics for a long time. Nobody's disputing that. These voter ID laws are complete silliness in the sense that there is essentially no voter fraud, and it's just an attempt to keep minorities from the ballot box, right? And it's essentially forms of institutional racism and dog whistle politics. That is bad, horrible, in my opinion. But what Hillary Clinton was talking about yesterday and what's happening out at the alt-right is like aligning with the Klan. In other words, that is so extreme, it's amazing that a modern campaign in 2016, when the country is as diverse as it is, when we're this far downrange from the civil rights movement, that you could have somebody running for president on a blatantly racist platform with blatantly racist employees and ideas. You know what I'm saying? It's really astounding.
So is the real danger here that that Donald Trump and this larger movement that he's inspired, I don't think he gave birth to it, but he inspired it, is the real danger that they have become somewhat mainstream, somewhat less fringe, they're more vocal, they feel empowered, they see Breitbart with its huge, huge readership, as opposed to Stormfront, is that really the crux of the danger here?
Yes, and I think Clinton made that point yesterday. What has happened is ideas that used to be basically blackballed from the mainstream, because why else would be Republicans be dog whistling, right? They weren't willing to say blatantly white people should rule or something like that. These ideas that had been just thrown like the N-word out of the mainstream, right, have now been given sanction and legitimacy by the Trump campaign. And it's sort of like he's unleashed the dogs, right? You know, I think all the time back to 2006 when George Allen was running for Senate in Virginia and he used the word macaca, and his campaign was essentially over within a few days, right?
Yes.
The Republican Party at that time was not going to have that kind of blatant racism. That was 10 years ago. And now you look at Trump has been using blatant racism constantly as a tool for mobilization with silence from the Republican leadership, basically.
I have to say that one thing that I've noticed that has gone from the fringe to the mainstream is, and I shouldn't say the mainstream, that's probably exaggerating. One thing that has gone from the fever swamps to Trump supporter, to a segment of Trump supporters that has become more prominent is old school anti-Semitism. In my life, I've really not seen this kind of these attacks on Jewish journalists, on, you know, this thing where you have these triple parentheses around the names of people who are Jews. This seems to be something that is new, not new in the sense that it's new, because we had, you know, the Father Coughlin and all of that in the 1940s, but new in the sense of it had been relegated to the fringe. It had been expunged from mainstream discourse, and now it seems to have popped back up, and it seems to have popped back up with Trump.
You are dead on correct. I mean, not only has Trump engaged in passing around blatant anti-Semitic imagery, like that picture with Clinton with the Star of David, and a more recent thing that he tweeted, which actually originated on David Duke's website, the anti-Semitic uproar that has come has been shocking. Reporters have been literally driven off of Twitter because they're getting pictures of like Jews having their heads blown off that comes out of Nazi imagery, right? And you know, a lot of this is coming from trolls related to the Daily Stormer website, which is a part of the alt-right. And this website is so grotesquely anti-Semitic. Well, first of all, it's named for Der Stürmer, right, a Nazi publication. But secondly,
right, not subtle.
Yeah, no, it's not so at all. But secondly, it's like you read that website every day and you see one slur for Jews after another, and an encouragement of rabid anti-Semitism and all the worst things about anti-Semitic thinking. Most of this stuff was really, really fringe and really, really out there and quickly denounced. And it's another example of how Trump is basically just letting the worst thinking ever, worst ideas ever, to come right into the mainstream.
Now, Heidi, those of us who read the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report have heard of names like Jared Taylor. So I've heard of some of these leaders of the white nationalist movement. For most of people, though, they are pretty obscure figures. How are they reacting to their newfound kind of celebrity? Infamy maybe is the best word, now that a major party's presidential candidate called many of them out by name.
Well, they're thrilled. I mean, they've been very happy since Donald Trump announced last June of 2015, because he came right out of the box bashing Mexicans, right, and immigrants. And these people like Jared Taylor, have been so excited about the Trump campaign. Taylor, for example, was involved in robocall efforts during the primaries in favor of Trump with some other white supremacists. And so they have been drawn into mainstream politics in a way that was not the case before. Usually these kinds of people would say a pox on both their houses. In other words, Republicans were just as bad as Democrats as far as they were concerned, because they weren't hard enough on racial issues. And in the last few days, since Bannon was put in as CEO on the Trump campaign, these people are gloating all over the Internet. They're like, Richard Spencer, a guy who's part of this alt-right movement, says we've taken over the Republican Party. So has other people like David Duke. I mean, they're absolutely thrilled.
Now, I guess I'm going to ask you a question that calls for a little bit of speculation. I, I think back to the 90s when you had these militias popping up and there were a bunch of incidents with the violent fringe right. There was Ruby Ridge, obviously Tim McVeigh's attack on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Office Building in Oklahoma City. And I think a lot of that is echoed by the rise of various white supremacist groups during Obama's presidency. It's a dynamic that your group has documented for 8 years now. And for the Clintons, you can go all the way back to, like, I know younger listeners won't know this name, but like Justice Jim Johnson, who is a Klan-backed politician in Arkansas, who was one of the first of Bill Clinton's like really arch enemies. Do you think this resonates for the Clintons in a way that it might not for other Democrats?
Probably. I mean, the 1990s saw so much violence under Clinton's tenure, right? First of all, the rise of the militias. There were 858 militias the year after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1996. I should say militias and anti-government groups. That experience was scary. It led to a lot of violence, as you pointed out. The time now with that Obama's been in office, those numbers are even higher of those kinds of conspiracy-laden extremist anti-government groups. And I think that both Clintons know what they're talking about when they talk about this movement. You know, Bill Clinton's been on record before talking about how people have enabled extremist thinking, about how politicians should be more responsible. That's, you know, that this can lead to domestic terrorism and violence and whatnot. So I think they're very keyed in on what the dangers are here. And given the last 8 years of violence we've had from white supremacists and anti-government folks, it's a scary thing. And we've never seen the white supremacist movement emboldened like it has been by Trump, which is never, not in my lifetime.
Can they put this toothpaste back in the tube if Trump is beaten by an 8-point margin or 9-point margin? Is that going to send a signal to the Republican mainstream that this kind of white ethnic nationalism is unacceptable? Or have we emboldened this generation of younger alt-right white supremacists to the point where they will feel forever that they have a place at the table in our civilized discourse?
Well, that's really the big question on the table, isn't it? I mean, what happens to the Republican Party? Does it essentially become taken over by this kind of extremism? If the party, if Trump loses, right, does the party reject these people? Do we get a split on the right? I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but I have to say one thing I am very concerned about is if Clinton were to win, these people are going to be so angry. And if the 90s were just the precursor, right, under Bill Clinton, we're going to have some serious violence.
Well, that's a cheering thought, Heidi Barrick.
Sorry.
I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Dave Zirin.
Getting late, I'm making my way over to my favorite place. I gotta get my body moving, shake the stress away. I wasn't looking for nobody when you looked my way. Possible candidate, yeah. Who knew that you'd be up in here looking like you do? You're making staying over here impossible. Baby, I'ma say your art is incredible. If you don't have to go, no. You know what just started? I just came here to party. Now we're rocking on the dance floor, acting naughty. Hands around my waist, just let the music play. We're hand in hand, chest to chest. Now we're face to face, 'cause I wanna take you away. Let's escape into the music, DJ, let it play. I just can't refuse it, like the way you do this. Keep on rocking to it, please don't stop the, please don't stop the music. I wanna take you away, let's escape into the music, DJ, let it stop the music. Please don't stop. Please don't stop.
Welcome back to the show. Now we have another guest whom we haven't had on for a while, for far too long, I think. Dave Zirin is the nation's radical sports reporter and sports editor. He's a unique voice in the progressive media. Dave, welcome back to the show, man.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks.
Folks, I love the Olympics. I love the Summer Olympics. I love the Winter Olympics, whatever. If they had a Fall and Spring Olympics, I would dig that too. This one had a lot of disturbing politics humming around in the background. I wanted to have Dave on during the Olympics, but our schedules didn't mesh. So I figured we'd do like an Olympics post-mortem, focusing on the rest of the story. First, let me ask you this, Dave. What do you think about the mainstream reporting on all the social upheaval that surrounded the games? Because on the one hand, I understand that ABC is broadcasting a sporting event. But what duty does it have as a broadcaster?
NBC.
NBC,
yeah.
Sorry. What duty does it have to let the audience know what else is happening?
It's a great question. I mean, but the fact of the matter is, it's not just the news in the country. It's the fact that the Olympics are at the center of that news. So in Brazil, I was there during part of the Olympics. I was there in May, and the discussions were about the debt, displacement, and hyper-militarization that was coming with the Olympics, and how could there be money for the Olympics when schools and hospitals were just getting cut to the bone. So the Olympics were the news story. So that's what NBC has to decide to do, is really, are we going to report on ourselves?
Now, Brazil's leftist president, Dilma Rousseff, was basically kind of deposed in a soft coup d'etat, or that process is ongoing. They started impeachment proceedings back in April. I think most people would say that these were trumped up charges. Was that at all related to the games? And what does it say about the political culture that they'd embark on what many people see as an illegitimate power grab when the whole world's attention would be on Brazil?
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to their arrogance. It also speaks to the fact that they want to go, I think, time the Olympics to all of this. Like, note that her final impeachment thing is happening just as we speak right now, and where she'll most certainly be convicted and removed. I mean, to try to coincide that with the idea of the Olympics, a new nationalism, a new leadership, that's what they're trying to pull off. It was timed, I think, exquisitely with the six-month gap, betting on what actually happened, which is that they were basically able to pull the Olympics off. It was a source of pride that they were able to do it, even with all the problems. And, you know, that's why the Ryan Lochte story was so freighted, too, because then it would, like, bring shame to what was, you know, a tremendous effort. But I think it was all time to that. So, to me, it's impossible to even tell the Olympic story, at least the recent one, without talking about the engineering of the removal of Dilma Rousseff.
Okay, and let's talk about the rest of the story. You wrote a piece of The Nation titled "Now That the Olympics Are Over, The Real Drama Begins." Listeners can catch that at thenation.com. When the games end, they always leave the host cities drowning in debt, right? But these games left Rio with a lot more to grapple with. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a land grab happening right now in Rio. The Olympics were always a part of that. Now that all of the Olympic stuff is being torn down, the possibility to buy and develop land in an area where some of the land values are like Bay Area prices, San Francisco, Oakland, that kind of thing. I mean, this is high-end stuff amidst a great deal of poverty. And so, to me, the Olympics were always an effort to sort of blaze that path for them to be able to take that land. And so, the land battles have already begun. And they're happening in the context of further cuts in social services just so the Olympics can be paid for. So that's what I mean by, like, the real battle has begun, because now we get the fallout.
And you mentioned a multi-billionaire development on one side of it, obviously supported by a lot of powerful people in Brazil who is pushing back on this land grab? You know, are there social movements rising up to resist this?
Yeah, the seeds of them are definitely there. There's PSOL, which is like an independent socialist party that has seats on the city council, and it has somewhat of a base in the city. There's the neighborhood associations. There's the homeless workers associations. They've been able to come together and actually do really good work. There's like new Black Lives Matter formations, which certainly influenced by the United States, but also being unfortunately inspired by an incredible spike in police killings of young Black men and women in the favelas. So what's interesting is that these movements have been managing to, if not thrive, at the very least begin to develop. It's because of the crisis in the Workers' Party, because of the crisis of Dilma. It's created more space for more formations. So there will be a resistance as this land grab continues.
And we're talking about entire neighborhoods. These are desperately poor neighborhoods that have been on, as Dave says, really valuable real estate. And, you know, the elite or members of the elite have eyed that real estate for a very long time before the Olympics came in. Dave, do we know, I mean, do we even know how many people were displaced from their homes to put on these games?
Yeah, the number that has been widely cited, academic journals, New York Times, Us in the Nation took a big look at this, and we're talking about 77,000 people. And right next to the Olympics, one of the communities that was able to survive barely, they went from 600 families to 20 families. They set up a museum of the removed. So it would be like this incredible exhibit that they did of their resistance, of all the favelas that were affected for putting on these Olympics over the course of 10 years.
And where were these people I mean, what happened to those people?
There are two new government housing created that's, you know, very impersonal, small, cold, metal boxes, usually controlled by some kind of militia as well. That would be one place, and they take a payout and go there, leave their family, leave their community, et cetera. The other is getting pushed out into new favelas in the exurbs, which are some of the fastest growing and also poorly served areas in the entire Rio state, the exurbs of Rio, the city. That's where people were getting pushed for the purposes of the Olympics.
And how do we know how much debt the Olympics have left Brazil with?
Well, we're not going to know that for a while, because there's like three different sets of books being being taken. So that will take a minute. But what do we know? We know there had to be a $900 million bailout just a few months back. We know there had to be an emergency $42 million bailout just to put on the Paralympics. So when you have expenditures like that, I mean, it's going to have to be paid for somehow.
And this seems, in your piece, you noted that that is kind of the norm. What is it that entices cities and countries to vie for the Olympics when they're going to be saddled with this enormous amount of debt? Is there an upside?
Well, it's
other
like
than
John
pride.
Carlos. Yeah. Like Carlos, the 1968 Olympian, he always likes to say this. He says, you want to know why they only have the Olympics every 4 years? Because it takes them 4 years to count all the money. But the problem is that the money is not a trickle-down proposition. So why do cities bid for these games? Because very powerful people in those cities stand to make an absolute killing and really privatize the profits of it while socializing the debt. It's a very shady enterprise. It's couched in all sorts of flowery language. And because of that pride issue, because of the idea of your city being associated with the Olympics, you're able to turn these games into this kind of neoliberal Trojan horse that pushes through these policies that people would otherwise oppose.
Dave, I'm gonna before I let you go, I'm gonna ask you, I wanna leave this on a positive note. So I noticed that the American women just dominated these games. The American men did well, but the women kicked butt. To what degree can we credit this to Title IX, which banned discrimination based on sex in all federally funded programs and forced colleges and universities to offer women opportunities to participate in sports that they never were able to participate in previously.
There is no question about it that this is yet more evidence that Title IX is one of the most progressive and far-reaching and important pieces of legislation in the last 50 years. If you just think of the number of people whom it's impacted, then you look at some of our heroes from these games, or sheroes, people like Kate Ledecky, Simone Biles, and you think about, like, how was it that they were able to have even the resources to dream that they could do what they did? And then you have to go to Title IX just like that. And that's certainly the case throughout all of the incredible people who, you know, showed up in Rio from the United States. Yeah, the women kick butt. It's one of those things where I'm not a big nationalism person, but, you know, watching it with my daughter, I mean, you could see why it affects you even against your better instincts.
Yeah, it really did. It really did. Dave Zirin, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it, man.
Nah, thank you. Keep doing what you do.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back with Rebecca Shuncup from Wonkette.
Touch of your hand, I want your leather studded kiss in the sand. I want your love, 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 love. I want your love. You know that I want you, and you know that I need you, and I want you bad, bad, oh man.
Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Rebecca Schoenkopf, which means pretty head, who is the proprietrix of a vile little snark knob you may know as Wonkette. Rebecca, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. It's been a while.
All of those things are true. Just five true things before breakfast.
I am all about veracity. So let me ask you this. How much fun would you be having with this election if you could use a time machine to go and visit November and know for absolutely sure that Trump doesn't like squeeze out a win?
Well, I don't know. It's a weird one.
It is taking like a psychic toll, isn't it?
It really is mean. And
it's a mean election.
We're we're mean people. I can't speak for you, but we at Wonkette are mean people. We're bad, very bad, uncivilized, and this one's just rough.
Yeah, it is, and there's a lot of lingering, like, grievances about the primaries. I see, at least in my circles.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Speaking of being mean at Wonkette, I have to tell you, I know some lefties who are mad at you because you use the C word, or I guess a variation on the C word, to refer to progressive champion Jill Stein. As a feminist...
It's an adjectival form of it, yes.
Adjectival. As a feminist, does using that word make you like a self-loathing Jew?
It's entirely possible. I was raised by... a mother for whom Lenny Bruce was the greatest possible hero. Free speech, free speech. I mean, she's always been all about, oh, Lenny Bruce. Okay, we get it, Mom, Lenny Bruce. But to me, I don't think the adjectival form of the C word or the noun form of it is any worse than calling a man a dick or a prick. Can I say those?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to probably bleep it out. But, you know, what I find interesting is...
If a man wants to be hateful about your gender, he can be hateful by using the word you. You know, he can be like, you. It doesn't have to be the C word.
What I find interesting is that the C word is... If you go to the UK, it's one of these weird differences, right? It is very benign. Like, they use it all the... Like, you would say...
Yeah.
Just in the way you would say if you were saying having drinks with a friend and you're being like, don't be such a dick. They do that. It doesn't really have the same charged.
No, it really doesn't.
No.
But anyway, so no, I personally don't see it as being a traitor to my gender. But I know that there are people who disagree with me about that. And that's fine. We can all have different thoughts.
See, folks, there's no softball interviews on Politics and Reality Radio. I told Rebecca that she always has fun on the show, and then, bam, I hit her with controversy. That's hard-hitting. And I should add that those same lefties, then got mad at me for not being offended, because, of course, I'd be offended if it were Hillary Clinton, whom I apparently worship. And such is life during election season. That gets us all the way back.
I really do think that's true about Jill Stein. And so I don't regret it at all. I do regret calling her a hag, because to me, that's much more gendered.
Is it ageist also?
It's super ageist. It's saying that an old woman has nothing to offer, you know, and that is not how I was raised. I was raised that the crones went out into the forest and danced naked in the circle. For real. So, you know, I am sorry I called her a hag, but as far as the C word, the way she's been about Hillary has been so deranged and bitter and like, I hope she goes to prison. Like, what is wrong with you? She's not going to prison for emails. Come on, stop it, Jill Stein.
Jill Stein went and sat at Vladimir Putin's table.
Yes.
At the... the RT conference.
And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of younger millennial progressives who are like, why are you being mad at communism? No, Putin is not a communist. Russia is not communist. Russia is hyper-capitalist at this point. You know, I mean, they think we're red-baiting because we're like, hey, Putin's not that good a guy. They have no idea what's going on. He's terrible.
I've also found that really weird, this idea of red-baiting. Like, this is a country run by right-wing oligarchs.
Yeah.
That's not red. I mean, that's just not... There has to be some other baiting. I mean, maybe we're right-wing oligarch baiting, but I'm not sure that I'll apologize for that.
Yeah. Now, Jill Stein's just... She's on my last nerve. I hate her the way a lot of people hate Hillary. And I feel like I should meditate or something because it's not good for me.
Now, I don't know if I should say this, but I will. Some inside baseball thing. So I am writing a piece about how Jill Stein and the Green Party. So a lot of people who say that they're supporting Jill Stein and the Green Party, it's out of opposition to the Democrats.
Right.
They don't really know about the Green Party per se. I used to be a Green. So
exhausting.
I found...
Being a Green was exhausting.
Exhausting, and they are a hot mess, and they spend most of their time arguing amongst themselves. And I went to The Nation. I was like, I'm going to write a piece that's not... a defense of Democrats, but says let's look at the Greens qua Greens. Let's forget about their relationship with the Democrats and just look at the Greens themselves. And they actually decided that they were uncomfortable doing that without a counterpoint. So in the I think September 21 issue, there's going to be me and then somebody arguing for the Greens.
Well, I don't see what's so wrong with saying, yes, the Democrats are a worthy party, worthy of our defense and our respect. Well, yes, the Democrats want to help poor people and not punch them in the face. Yes, the Democrats are good. No, the Democrats are not all Wall Street oligarch shills. The old lady stuffing the envelopes at the Pottawatomie County, Oklahoma Democratic Club is not a goddamn oligarch. Stop it already.
Well, so I'm in the middle here, right? So I am extremely frustrated with the mainstream, with mainstream Democratic policies up until maybe in the last few years, the Democrats have adopted an policy agenda that is much more to my liking than it was 5 years ago or 4 years ago. And I am frustrated with the influence of money in politics in general. And I remain that way about Democrats as well as Republicans. But I mean, the thing that I would phrase it differently, which is that there is a group of people on the left who don't recognize the success that a lot of good people have had pushing the Democrats to the left, right? They're kind of stuck in the 90s. It used to be the case in the 90s when I was flirting with the Greens in the 90s and early 2000s, there was a kernel of truth to the idea that there were that these two parties were way too close. And you know, any metric you want to look at, voting, congressional voting records, you can look at the party platform, you can look at the base, the ideology of the base. The Democrats have demonstrably moved to the left, as the Republicans have moved to the right, and they're just stuck in this idea that there's not a dime's worth of distance. Anyway, before we use up all our time, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of stories that I saw on Wonkette.com this week.
Okay.
Now, all this sexual harassment at Fox News has been come kind of burbling up, and then this week, Andrea Tonteros, how do you pronounce that?
I think the way you just did. Okay. I don't know. I don't watch Fox News. I only read her name.
Yes. Okay. Andrea Tonteros, whom you rightly note is a horrible person, right?
She's terrible.
Terrible.
She's a big jerk.
Total jerk face. She filed a lawsuit that jives with everything we've heard about Roger Ailes, but also implicates a whole bunch of other people. Rebecca, what did she allege?
Well, she's terrible and a jerk, first of all. But even jerks get feminism, you know. So she says that several hosts, and they have now been named, it's of course Bill O'Reilly, who has been sued for all the falafel in all the land in the past. Bill O'Reilly, Steve Doocy, and Gretchen Carlson also complained about Steve Doocy.
Steve Doocy is creepy.
You know, what's interesting is all these years, I said Brian Kilmeade was the one who had a whiff of date rape about him. And Steve Doocy was just this fella.
The goofy one.
Apparently, Steve Doocy is mean to women all the time. So Steve Doocy, Bill O'Reilly, some guy I've never heard of, and former Senator Scott Brown.
Scott Brown. Pretty boy Scott Brown.
Pretty boy Scott Brown. So Scott Brown came out yesterday and said, hey, I wouldn't sexually harass anybody. Andrea Tonteros is the real sexual harasser because she was asking me about my Playgirl centerfold and it made me very uncomfortable. I was only 22. Blah, 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 blah. And then he said, you know, obviously, if I had done anything wrong, they would have fired me immediately. So this guy is terrible at reading as he is at getting elected to the Senate. In fact, the point is nobody ever got fired for dozens and dozens of years, and everybody knew about it, and everybody was getting sexually harassed.
Yeah, and it was only when the very prominent, when very prominent anchors started speaking out. It stayed kind of well-known secret until the lid was blown off. So
And the lid only got blown off because they fired Gretchen Carlson, and she was like, "Oh, really? You're going to fire me? Guess what?" And then everybody started speaking about it, and everybody was like, how come Megyn Kelly hasn't defended Roger Ailes? That is so unloyal of her. And she was like, oh, why haven't I defended Roger Ailes? Because he smushed on me too. And everybody was like, oh, boom, he's gone, bye.
Yeah, and now they're worried that Megyn Kelly,
by the way.
She's really pretty, but they're all worried that Megyn Kelly is going to fly the coop. Her contract expires, I think, next year. And
she's very valuable.
Oh, she is. I mean, she is the it girl for Fox. And they're even talking about how it may be that they have to part ways with Willow to keep Megyn Kelly because they hate each other.
Well, I would do that. I mean,
you know, I would easily do that.
The old people watch Bill O'Reilly, but the future of Fox News is going to be the young, smart, extremely attractive one, you know.
I mean, other old people watch her show. All their audience is old.
Oh, that's true. She's really pretty. I don't know if you've noticed.
I also think she's pretty.
Now, we watched her moderate that debate, and we were like, oh.
She's hot.
She's so ugly. God. Look at that. We were just kidding. She's very pretty.
Hey, so wait. What did Scott Brown do to Andrea Tonteras?
Oh, he just, like, sort of came up behind her in the cafeteria and put his hands, like, down under her waist, you know, and just was like, hey, do you want to come to my cabin with me or whatever? He's just gross. They're all gross.
Yeah, he is gross. So I'm old and I can't keep up with all these internet memes. Rebecca, what is a vagenda and why is it bent on manocide?
The vagenda and the manocide are poetry.
It's a great rock band.
She is gonna manicide you right in the vagenda. there's some crazy pizza place or lube place or something in Maine. It's a gun shop. There you go. A lube pizza gun shop. And they said that Hildebeest would manicide you with her vagenda. And people are very pleased with that because it's awesome.
Now, but they put up this sign in 2014. And so there's this obscure wing nutty gun shop in Maine. And it was before Clinton announced. So that makes it a bit random, I think. But then it becomes a viral sensation this week, 2 weeks later. Do you ever have posts or old tweets that, like, lay dormant for long periods of time and then get a lot of attention? You can't figure out how?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is it? What made this go viral this week? Is it just
I don't know.
Some famous person saw it and retweeted it and then it...
Something. I don't know.
The internet is mysterious
this way. I don't
understand
marketing.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm very bad at it.
I laugh because you are marketing. You have a vagenda in your...
Pow! Right in the vagenda.
Right in the vagenda. Speaking of agendas, Rush Limbaugh uncovered quite the plot this week. The Obama administration, having basically ruined the rest of the country, is now setting its sights on like rural America and yeoman farmers who are, I guess, the last redoubt of traditional conservative values. How are they going to corrupt the farmers?
Lesbians. The Department of Agriculture is going to make all the lesbians move out to the country and go be farmers.
What is the real story here?
The rural areas won't be Republican anymore because all the lesbians will take over with their Subarus. And
Is it Subarus now, no longer Volvos?
You know, it's always been a little of both.
Okay, all right. So what is the real story? So this
was, I don't
this
even was, remember.
This was Rush Limbaugh.
I don't even remember what the real story is.
I mean, the real story. Yeah, I do. It was like the Department of Agriculture held some conference for rural LGBT people.
Oh, yeah. And that was it.
That was it. They had a conference. Because, you know what?
But you know what?
They already exist.
Lesbians would be great farmers. Like, look at Portland.
Look at Portland. Good point.
Who do you think is... You know, having the goat farm with the artisanal cashmere cheese. I don't know. It's lesbians,
well,
obviously.
Okay, but that is actually one of the things that I find really ironic about that, because in the circles I travel in, the lesbian organic farmer is is like a cliche, right? I mean, yeah. The idea that they don't exist is a bit odd. And I should point out that I live in New York's 19th district, where we have Zephyr Teachout running for Congress. She's good. She's great, actually. And the person she defeated in the primary was also really good. It's a guy
was
named...
Was she a lesbian farmer?
It's a guy named Will Yandick. And Will Yandick is an out gay man. And guess what he does for a living?
Is he a farmer?
He's an organic farmer.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. It is nice. So here's a really weird story I saw at Wonkhead this week. It's about a rodeo clown losing his mind. And I'm not afraid of clowns. That's an odd cliche. But I do find some of them a bit unsettling. Like, not all clowns, yeah. But some of them, right? Anyway, while entertaining a group of children at the Calhoun County Fair in Michigan, right?
Yeah.
He randomly went on this rant. Let's listen.
You're either a boy or a girl. Y'all understand? If you're confused, you need help.
What was supposed to be a family-friendly event.
Here at the rodeo, we are not gender-friendly.
Turned controversial during the rodeo at the Calhoun County Fair. Children were lining up for the chance to ride animals themselves when rodeo clown Rockin' Robbie Hodges drew laughs with his gender identity comments.
Everybody here who is really sure they're a boy, raise your hand. If you can tinkle on a fire, you go to the boys' room.
So, Rebecca, do you have any sociological insights into why this rodeo clown felt the need to share his views about gender with a crowd full of small children?
I do have sociological insights about this. And that is when Robin came into the chat cave and said, oh, there's this rodeo clown who's going on rants about transgender children. And I was like, oh, is that the same one who was racist about President Obama 2 years ago? Because apparently rodeo clowns have a tendency to be super weird right-wing nut jobs. And I think... it's because they were cowboys and then they got hurt and ended up being given a job as the clown.
Is that how you become a rodeo clown?
I think that's how you become a rodeo clown.
You know, the insights that I get reading Lunkhead are really remarkable. Rebecca, I want to thank you so much. I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to, first of all, to enlighten me about how people become rodeo clowns, and also to share with me your grievances about Jill Stein and other things.
I just think she's the worst.
Folks, I'm going to have to get a counterpoint on. Maybe I'll have Jill Stein on. I did interview her in 2012. In the meantime, we're going to take...
I voted for Nader in 96 and 2000. When he ran again in 2004, I was like, are you kidding me, Ralph Nader?
Indeed, indeed. Anyway, Rebecca, we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Bye.
I would also like to thank Heidi Barrick from the Southern Poverty Law Center and Dave Zirin from The Nation. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. And you can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever you find it. You can also write an email complaining about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I want to thank Digby and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show there. And of course, I want to thank all of you terrific people for tuning in. Have a good week.
When you're on the street, you got to be able to pick out the easy meat with your eyes closed. Then moving in silence. When the moment is right, without thinking.